Okay, it's late in the afternoon. Everyone has had a long day, and so I'm going to start off, first of all, by pointing out two people in the audience. I could probably point out a lot of people in the audience, but we have in the audience Dr. Peggy Goodman, who is an emergency medicine physician from North Carolina, and she has been trying to raise awareness about the issue of animal abuse in the context of child development and intimate partner violence within her professional view. Thank you for being here. And Peggy has organized a session for tomorrow morning where I can go into a lot more detail about this issue. And I also want to point out Dr. Gary Petronic, who is a doctor of veterinary medicine and who is really the leading national, international expert on the problem of animal hoarding. If you've not met Gary, please meet with him. If we look at the sheer numbers of animals that are very likely to suffer abuse or neglect, it probably is partially related to animal hoarding issues. And so we're in some ways talking about the tip of the iceberg here in terms of the number of animals that are sometimes harmed. So Gary is just a great person to get to know. And I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this. And this is the thing that works, huh, Tom?
Hopefully.
Okay. But you modify. See, this is one of those PowerPoint things where you had something in there, forgot about it, it doesn't show up on your black background, which is a much nicer one. Okay. What I am going to talk about very quickly, because I want to leave time for questions, is the issue of how animal abuse is specifically implicated in cases of intimate partner violence. And I like to borrow a phrase that John Fantuzzo, a very well-known researcher on children exposed to domestic violence, has talked about. And it's the idea of urgent knowing, that we have to sometimes focus our research efforts, not necessarily on answering a theoretical question or a conceptual question, but to try to provide information that may be valuable for people who are in the field doing work with victims, with perpetrators. And John has done excellent work on children's exposure to domestic violence and the age ranges that are involved, how often children are the ones who make 911 calls to police departments. And I have tried to see how my own work might be useful to those working in the domestic violence field. Just a quick example of what we're talking about when we're talking about the link, which sometimes is a bit nebulous, but here we have a gentleman who has been arrested assaulting his children, so we've got child maltreatment, tried to choke his wife. We've got attempted murder in many jurisdictions, intimate partner violence, and we see at the end that he also has animal cruelty charges pending. So those concentric, those rings that Phil used in his presentation are an illustration of how there are potentially connections among all types of violence. Not in every case. I don't think we want to oversell this issue that animal abuse will necessarily be a 100% predictor of other forms of violence, but at least we should start paying attention to the phenomena. When I began work in this area, I discovered very quickly that there was absolutely no research on the prevalence of animal abuse in the context of intimate partner violence. And so I decided that maybe if there wasn't published research, I could at least go to agencies that deal with intimate partner violence, and maybe they kept statistics on this phenomenon. We did a national survey, the paper up in the upper left-hand corner, a national survey in the United States. We had three criteria for enlisting participants in our survey. The agency had to be one of the larger domestic violence shelters in their state. They had to have a residential program for women, so women could stay overnight or be in a program for 30, 45 days. And they had to have some kind of children's program. All three of those had to be in place. And then we just selected one agency from each state. We had over 80% response rate in this particular survey. And it was a very simple survey. We asked the program directors, who were the usual respondents, do women who come to your shelters ever talk about cases of animal abuse? Over 80% said yes, they do. We constantly are hearing stories about this. Do the children talk about animal abuse? Well, they'll talk about it. Over 60% said yes, they talk about it, but they'll tell stories, they'll draw pictures for us of what's happened to their animals, sometimes horrific pictures. We asked, do you believe that animal abuse and domestic violence coexist in the same families? Over 80% said yes. We believe that's the case. And then we asked, do you have a question on your intake form that deals with animal abuse? Less than a third did. So even though there was an acknowledgement that this was an issue for them and for their clients, they were not systematically gathering any data about how common this was. And so that led us to do a very small scale study, battered women's reports of their partners in children's cruelty to animals in a local shelter. The first question we asked women, these were all volunteers, very small sample, 38 women, we wanted to know whether pet ownership among domestic violence victims was lower, higher, the same as in the general population. In this small scale study, 74% of the women reported having pets. That's comparable to John's comment about pet ownership in the United States. If there are children present in a home who are school age, pet ownership in the US is 70 to 90%. So they were right on the mark with regard to that. In the questionnaire we developed for these women, one of the questions is, has your partner ever hurt or killed one or more of your pets? And we were really startled by the percentage of women who said yes to that question. And so with funding from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, another great New Jersey, Morristown group, they funded a larger scale project in which we enlisted the assistance of 100 women who were victims of intimate partner violence at 5 different shelters in the state of Utah. We also secured the assistance of over 100 women from the community who reported to us that they had never experienced violence in their adult intimate partner relationships. Okay? So those are our two groups. And because pet ownership was so high in our pilot study, we screened for pet ownership. Every participant in the study either had to have a pet currently or within the past 12 months. So that's a common denominator for all these women. When we asked the women who were not victims that question, 5% said that their partner had hurt or killed one or more of their pets. When we asked the victims of domestic violence, 54% said that their pets had been hurt or killed by their partners. Yet the chi-square was, you know, off the charts in terms of significance. Very big difference between these two groups. So very clearly, within shelter samples of women, if there's pet ownership, it appears that animal abuse is quite common, disturbingly common. Now, I can't say anything about women who are victims of domestic violence who don't go to shelters. That's a very difficult population to study, and we simply don't know the answer to whether that you'd find comparable statistics with them. Another finding in our study, which was disturbing, was that 67% of the children reported that they had been exposed to animal abuse. In some cases, the animal abuse was purposefully perpetrated in front of them, and they were made to watch. Okay? One case I will never forget, a social worker in Canada reported to me where a man bludgeoned the family cat in front of his 4-year-old daughter and his wife. He made them sit on the couch and watch him as he did it. Then he put the carcass of the cat in his daughter's bedroom. He took his 4-year-old daughter, locked her in the bedroom, unscrewed the light bulb from the ceiling fixture, and locked that 4-year-old in her bedroom overnight with the carcass of the dead cat. Can't imagine what that child's experience being exposed to that. So very clearly, the children witnessed this. The good news is that half of the children we interviewed said they tried to protect their pet when violence erupted in their home. The bad news part of that, I mean, that means they still have empathy for their animals. The bad news is that children are endangering themselves at times by getting in between the batterer and the pet that is about to be abused, just like children are endangered when they try to protect their mothers in some cases of domestic violence. So that was information that I'm currently pursuing in another study, but it was very disturbing to see how high those numbers were. Now, the study that I just reported to you was done in Utah. Neighboring state, Utah and Colorado are very different states, and those of you who are from Colorado originally could talk about all the differences. Now, we drove down I-70, and I saw all those barriers that go down I-70, and I wondered if it's Colorado trying to keep Utah out, or Utah's trying to keep Coloradans out of the state. But some people might say, well, you know, Utah is kind of a quirky state. Maybe those numbers are specific to Utah. Well, colleagues of mine in Australia asked to use the same assessment instrument that I developed. They too had a sample of over 100 women who were victims of intimate partner violence, 100 women from the community who were not victims by self-report. They asked the same question about hurting or killing of animals, 0% for the non-victims and 53% for the victims of intimate partner violence. Very, very close parallels. I don't have it in my slides, but we also conducted a study with men in prison in Utah. Very small sample again, only 38 men, if I recall correctly, in that study as well, where there were pets in the home. And we asked the same question, but from the perspective of being a perpetrator of violence. All of the men were in prison for violent crimes. They had to have either been convicted of a domestic violence offense to be in our study, or they were convicted of some other offense, but they admitted to engaging in domestic violence. For that group of men, where there were pets in the family, 55% of them said they had hurt or killed animals of their intimate partner. So whether it's the voices of the victims or the voices of the perpetrators, we're getting really close correspondence on these types of numbers. And I put that sidebar in because the Australian study had a small group of women who were 60 years of age and older. And so this is not confined to just younger victims. Older victims were reporting this experience as well. In our study, the original study that I told you about a quarter of the women said that they delayed going to the shelter out of concern for their pet's welfare. And this is not paranoia, this is not unfounded fear. In one case, a woman had gone to a domestic violence shelter. She had decided to leave her abusive husband. She knew that the shelter would not accept her dog, so she had to leave the dog behind. And somehow, this should never have happened, but somehow, after being at the domestic violence shelter for a day or two, her husband managed to have a small package delivered to her at the shelter, addressed to her. When she opened it, it was an audio cassette. And when she played it, it was of her husband torturing her dog. The woman packed her bags, she left the shelter, and they never saw her again. So there are clearly cases where the fears that women have about leaving their animals behind is a well-founded fear. And I think what it speaks to is that the resources that these women have are often very, very limited. They can't afford to go to a boarding kennel and say, you know, keep my animals there for the next month and a half while I'm at the domestic violence agency. They may be isolated in their own community from friends and neighbors and may not be able to go to a friend or neighbor and say, can you keep my cats while I take care of some business I need to take care of? So very clearly, they're stuck. There are programs now, as John mentioned and Diane mentioned, that are trying to remove at least this one obstacle that is in the path of women who are trying to seek safety. After having published a couple of papers in this area, I started to get phone calls in my office at Utah State University saying, Dr. Ashiel, we heard about your work on domestic violence and the issue of women not leaving because they're worried about their pets. Can you tell us how to set up a program to shelter pets? Jeez, I'm the ivory tower person. I sit, you know, do the develop questionnaires and regression analyses and stuff like that. I'm not in the field doing this, but what those phone calls told me is that there's a void of information in the practice field. Animal welfare people were calling me. Domestic violence agencies were calling me. So I went back to the Dodge Foundation. I said, you know, why should every agency reinvent the wheel when they're trying to develop these programs? I would like a grant to interview agencies that are already doing this, get their wisdom, put it in one resource, and then make it available to, you know, 200 or 300 people who might be interested. And so I got a grant to develop this booklet, Safe Havens for Pets. It was supposed to be like a 20 or 30 page booklet, and we were gonna print, you know, a few hundred copies to distribute to anyone who might be interested. And as I developed my questionnaire to interview people, I wound up with a 144 question protocol for doing phone interviews. Some of the people that responded to me were saints, because they were on the phone with me for 2 hours or longer answering all my questions, because they also recognized that the information should be out there and available. And they said, not only will we answer all your questions, we'll send you our forms. You can put our forms in your booklet, because everybody hates developing their own forms. So let them, you know, plagiarize, as Phil said. Just take anything they want, modify it, use it for their own agency. That was wonderful. So the 20 to 30 page booklet became a 100 page report on 41 different agencies' wisdom about how to do these programs. And now I was in trouble, because when I budgeted for the project, I actually weighed, you know, 30 pages, what the size of the envelope needed to be, what the postage was going to be, and I was in trouble. So I went back to the Dodge Foundation and I said, you know, I need more money because it's a bigger report than I expect. And they said, no, absolutely not. What we're going to do is we're going to give you enough money to print 2,000 copies. We want you to distribute it at no cost to any agency that wants a copy, animal welfare, child welfare, law enforcement, domestic violence agencies. And so that's the first time that I ever had a granting agency give me more money than I originally asked for. And so in 2 years, all 2,000 copies of that booklet were distributed, and now it is available on a number of different websites nationally where people can download the entire booklet at no cost. And it's a guideline for agencies who are considering doing this, because there are liability issues, there are veterinary care issues, there are safety issues for victims of violence, there are safety issues for the workers who are at domestic violence shelters, and for foster families that will take these animals in. And that was the purpose of that booklet. And then Allie Phillips, a couple of years ago, developed this other program, Safe, the Pets and Women's Shelter program. And this was designed to help domestic violence agencies think about being able to keep a limited number of animals on site in their own facilities. Yes, there are allergy issues. Yes, there are animal behavior issues. Yes, there are child behavior issues. 4 minutes? Or was that, I'm doing okay? Or
well, we got
keep
five.
Going?
From, we got 5 minutes.
Got five minutes.
Our session is over. No, it's what we can okay. Lead into other people's time.
Okay, great. And so that also is available at American Humane's website, and it provides guidance on how to accommodate animals on site. Simple, very simple way sometimes, taking a storeroom and putting some portable pet carriers in there that are away from the everyday action of the shelter, but it still allows the adult victim and child victims to be able to visit their animals. The Cadillac of this program is located in Las Vegas, Noah's Ark, where a premier animal shelter was built on the secure facilities of the Domestic Violence Agency. And so the women and children can essentially go anytime they want to go see how their animals are doing and to continue to interact with them. Okay, state of Colorado. In 2006, Maine became the first state to specifically include animals in orders of protection that a victim of violence could obtain from the court. Colorado joined the group last year. There was a statute that was a criminal statute that already allowed animals to be included in orders of protection. This was a civil statute. It was signed by Governor Ritter. This past year, and it's an added protection which in a sense tells perpetrators, we know what you're up to, okay? If it's a regular order of protection or a typical one prior to this, it will tell a perpetrator, you cannot threaten your children, you cannot harm your children, you cannot threaten your wife, you cannot harm your wife. But if a perpetrator could still control the animals, they could still intimidate and frighten members of the family and still be abiding by that order of protection. And so this essentially is a message from the judiciary saying, you can't do that either because the animals are protected. And if you threaten or harm them, you're in violation of that order as well. A big step, I believe. Another change we're seeing is that this whole issue of animal abuse as it's related to intimate partner violence is working its way into mainstream research on intimate partner violence. Jeff Edelson, who is probably one of the premier researchers in the field of intimate partner violence and batterer intervention programs and children's exposure, just a couple of years ago developed a new exposure to domestic violence assessment instrument. Any of you who work in the field of domestic violence and children's exposure know that the best way that people were measuring exposure was, do they live in the same house as a victim of domestic violence? That's a lousy proxy measure for what the exposure really means. And so what this instrument tries to get at are the different ways that children may have been exposed, and then if they endorse an item, how close were they to the incident that occurred? A much better instrument, and I really get on my knees and thank Jeff for this. He included an item in his 10-item assessment that asks about exposure to threatened or actual animal abuse by a batter. So what I think we will see in the future, major studies that use this assessment instrument, it will be one way for us to gather some data about this particular phenomena that we did not have before. The one last thing that I will tell you about is something that I really never thought would happen. But about 2 years ago, I was asked to present at a workshop in Washington, D.C. You get one of those, you ever get one of those emails where you wonder whether it's like one of those joke things? Like the Nigerian people who have all that money and they're putting their bank account. Okay, this was one of those examples. It was an invitation from the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development to give a talk at a invitation-only workshop they were going to have in D.C. Okay. It turns out that that agency, part of the National Institutes of Health, and the Mars Candy Corporation had formed a public-private partnership to re-examine the whole area of human-animal interactions in childhood and adolescence. There had been one other major NIH study, which was 1987, right, Gary? The Pets and Human Health study, right around that time, where it was kind of a taking stock of what we knew, and the message at that time was, boy, you know, there are a lot of studies, but a lot of them are small samples, and there's no control group, and they're not always designed very well, they're cross-sectional studies, very little longitudinal research. And so they decided that they were going to infuse money into a major research program. And about a year after that workshop, there was a request for proposals from the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development and the Institute of Nursing for projects related to human-animal interactions in childhood and adolescence. The reason Mars was involved is Mars is one of the largest, if not the largest, candy confection company in the world. They have the Waltham Pet Health Division, and they do major research on pet health in the UK and other areas. And so, first week at DU as a new professor there, I was teaching my first new class there and decided to write an R01. And I don't know if any of you have ever written an R01, but for this particular R01, the instruction booklet that you can download, the instruction booklet is 220 pages. Okay. That's the, I think, the screening mechanism for the week apart, as soon as you see that. And didn't think I would get it because it was my first attempt at an R01 and I knew it was going to be pretty competitive. Well, lo and behold, I got it. And so I am now involved in a collaborative project with the Colorado Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We are going to attempt to recruit 300 women from domestic violence agencies around the state of Colorado. We are going to be also looking at children in these families between 7 and 12 years of age. And what is really exciting for me is that this was a funding of a longitudinal study. So we're hoping to follow up these women and children for a 2-year period after the initial assessment, because in this particular field, there is virtually no longitudinal research. And we simply do not know what happens to these children and women over time. And so we're going to be asking about exposure to domestic violence, exposure to animal abuse, as well as a variety of other mental health issues in childhood. And I can't tell you, it was just a dream come true in terms of the next step in research in this area. Those of you who want to find out more about how the NIH is involved in this, the American Psychological Association just this month released publication of this book. I have a chapter in that book. There's another book that NIH was involved with that Phil has a chapter in on the therapeutic aspects of human-animal interaction. Again, it's a big deal for American Psychological Association to get involved in this because they've kind of resisted the human-animal interaction issue for many, many decades. And that's it.